It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear about efforts in the state to help Native American youth become doctors.
First, if you've been following Governor Scott Walker's efforts on the presidential campaign trail, you'll know that he's made Kohl's, the Wisconsin-based department store chain, a major part of his story. According to a new investigation, though, by the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, there's another story about Governor Walker's favorite retailer that isn't being told.
3 years ago, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation awarded a $62.5 million package of tax credits to Kohl's. That's the biggest state subsidy for creating jobs under the Walker administration. But according to the new investigation, Kohl's isn't generating the promised jobs or investment.
Here with us now to talk about the story is Dee Hall. She's managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, take us back to 2012 for a moment when the WEDC WEDIC, commonly called, and Kohl's announced this package involving up to $62 million in tax credits. Can you spell out what the deal looked like then?
Well, the idea was to generate, Kohl's planned to generate 3,000 new jobs and to spend $250 million on a new corporate headquarters. And the idea behind the tax credits, which are tied to the creation of jobs and the spending of money, the capital expenditures, was that you would allow them to do this, make this big move to consolidate all their operations in Menominee Falls and to greatly increase the number of people who work for Kohl's in Wisconsin.
And this was part of a wider effort to create jobs in the state.
Right. I mean, this was at a time when Governor Walker was really trying to meet his 250,000 new private sector job goal. And so there were 28 awards given to 24 companies within Wisconsin that the agency has recently acknowledged did not go through the full financial review that they now require of all of their deals. The idea was that essentially, you know, they were doing more of an ad hoc system for checking out the companies and their ability to carry out these projects. And so that's what we looked at. That was the purpose of the story, was actually just to look at all of the projects that we could, figure out where they stand, how close they are to meeting their goals, what kind of tax credits they've qualified for already, which of their goals didn't they meet. So that's how Kohl's, and Kohl's being the largest one, of course, we paid the most attention to that.
And what did WEDIC say about the financial scrutiny they did or didn't give to this agreement with Kohl's?
Well, with the Kohl's deal, I did talk with former WEDC chairman or chief executive officer, and he indicated to Paul Jaden, and he indicated to me that he was actually pretty comfortable with the level of scrutiny. They had a long period of negotiations. They always had, folks from their legal department, underwriters with him when he was talking with Kohl's. But he did acknowledge that he was literally stunned when he heard that they actually weren't planning to build the full-fledged new headquarters, but instead decided to buy space close to the existing headquarters and then to convert that into part of its headquarters campus. So that was a way that the company saved a lot of money. But, of course, then it did not engage in the kind of spending that the incentives were intended to create.
Talking to Dee Hall with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism about the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, and in particular its agreement with the Kohl's department store chain involving up to $62 million in tax credits. Dee, walk us through the gap between the hopes, the expectations when it came to job creation, and what you found in terms of what's actually happened since that agreement was made.
So we looked at the WEDC website and we found sort of a curious pattern that happened, which was that the first year of the award, the company qualified for job credits for creating over 900 jobs. So it looked like they just shot right out of the gate, and they have until 2023 to create all these jobs. But year one, they created almost a third of the jobs. But then the next year it went down into the 700s, and the current number is down below 500. And so what we discovered was, unlike deals that they do today, the deal that was struck with Kohl's and a couple of other companies as part of their enterprise zone program allows a company to get a credit for each year they have a job. So even if the job goes away the next year, the company does earn an incentive, a tax credit, for having that job. And that program has now been changed to require a 5-year retention for each job, with the notion, of course, that a permanent job is better than a temporary job.
And one question is how many jobs? Another question, as I gather from your reporting, is what kind of jobs? How much do they pay to qualify for these tax credits?
These particular jobs, to qualify for the tax credit, they're supposed to pay at least $30,000 a year, and they're supposed to come with benefits. And so that is what the agency says it has looked at, that it's only counting those jobs. It is not counting the lower paid clerk jobs, for example, store associate jobs. So that is what the company and the agency say that the company is receiving incentives for.
Now, when I said that number, $62.5 million, I think it was, in tax credits, that doesn't mean that Kohl's got this up front. They're, in a way, having to earn it as they go. Is that right?
Right. That's right. They did not get $62.5 million in the bank. And really, they are supposed to prove that they have actually created each of these jobs and that they have actually made these capital expenditures to qualify for the credits. And the agency insists that, in fact, they look at down to the payroll to the individual person and that they are required to file very detailed reports about their capital expenditures. I don't have access to that information right now. I know that in their contract they listed as being not subject to the open records law. So we didn't actually even try to obtain that source documentation, but you know the agency assures me that they actually are doing quite a bit of due diligence on the company to ensure that they qualify for all their tax credits.
On the side of the company involved here, Kohl's, to be clear, there's no indication that they did anything that violated the law. Is that right?
No. And in fact, there was nothing about the deal that violated the law. It's just that they changed the way the program works to now make it more stringent, to make it so that companies must keep these jobs for a longer period of time than just 1 year or so. That's a change in the program. I mean, there were 3 large awards given as part of this group of 24 companies and 28 awards that were not subjected to the normal scrutiny, and 3 of those are enterprise zones, and all 3 of them have similar requirement that really the job doesn't have to be retained for any particular length of time. It can go away after a year.
This comes amidst a lot of criticism of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation from Democrats in the legislature, also from some Republicans in the legislature. Has this been the biggest issue, or are there other things that have taken center stage?
Oh, no, I think there are probably bigger issues. This was sort of an offshoot of a story that I did while I was working at the Wisconsin State Journal about a much smaller award. It was $500,000, but there was a lot of concern about the fact that it was being pushed by one of the top people in the Department of Administration, that the company had lied on its application for a loan, claiming it had never, it wasn't being sued, and that, you know, everything was fine when it was actually falling apart. And the company was owned actually by a major donor to Governor Walker's gubernatorial campaign. So it had a lot of those issues going around it. This was the first deal that we discovered where they did not do what is called a staff review, which is a more stringent look at the viability of the company and the viability of the project that they hope to earning credits or incentives for.
And you point out that this isn't unique to WEDEC, which is a relatively new institution here in the state. You write that Kohl's had, and the government had some scrutiny before for deals with the state. What else had happened even before WEDEC came into existence and Governor Walker came into office?
Well, actually, the Department of Commerce was the subject of several very critical stories, in which the agency would hand out money, but then companies would not do what they promised to do. And literally nobody would just check back with them and ensure that they were doing what they were supposed to do. There was a lack of accountability, and I wrote about that, and the Journal Sentinel wrote a lot about that, different deals that went through where nobody just checked. Nobody, like it was a loan, and they didn't ask, hey, where's our loan payment? You know, the kind of thing that a bank would always do or anywhere else. I've never run into a situation where you'd get a loan and then the lender would sort of forget to collect it. But that was actually happening under Commerce. And to some extent, in the early years of WEDC, there were some concerns about that as well, that certain loans just were not being collected upon.
We'll leave it there for now. Dee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, guys.
That was Dee Hall from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She joined us to talk about her latest piece on Kohl's and the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, often called WEDIC, and what's come out of that partnership 3 years later. Brett Benally Thompson dreamed of being a doctor from a young age, but gave up his dream after his grandpa discouraged him. But in his 20s, he overcame his doubts to become a palliative care doctor. Today, he helps other Native peoples pursuing healing careers.
My name's Brett Benally Thompson. I'm a palliative care and hospice physician at the University of Wisconsin. When I was 8 years old, I was at my grandparents' house on the reservation, and my grandpa asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I said, I want to be a doctor. His response to me, this man who loved me very much and took really good care of me, his response was, well, you're too stupid to be a doctor. My grandpa is really wise, so I thought, oh, I'm okay. I believed him for about 20 years, and then in my late 20s, I was a cop, and I was driving my patrol car down the road. I had this really striking thought that came to me. It was like somebody else was telling me, you know, you can do this. I decided right then that, you know, that was what I was going to be, was a doctor. What we do as physicians is really precious. I hear people's stories all the time. A lot of times they're really tough stories. And, you know, sometimes we can fix them. Sometimes they don't need fixing, but we still hear their stories. We walk people through that part of their life that they're there asking for us for help. Most people don't want to leave this life, and most people don't want to leave their families and the people that they love. As a vet myself, yeah, I a lot of times will connect with veterans. I figure they probably suffered in some way to take care of us. So it's something I can give back to them by taking care of them. A lot of times the families or patients thank me for taking care of them. I say, well, it's an honor for me to take care of you. I don't tell people that I'm Native unless they ask me, you know, because I'm one of those guys that could pass for either. But it's definitely a part of who I am spiritually. The way I've been taught and the way I've learned as an adult in our ceremonies and our way of life really helps keep me grounded in what I do. Part of what I really love about being a physician is I get to go back and talk to young people about what it's like to be a doctor. And if they have any inkling about being a doctor, that it's actually something that they can do. Some people go right from high school to college to medical school. That's probably the most common way that people become physicians, is they just go straight through. But my path has never been a straight path. I've had a very rich and full life, but it's taken a lot of twists and turns, and I think a lot of Native people are that way. We don't have the same opportunities, maybe don't have the same resources that some other people have. When I encounter an obstacle, if I can't go over it or through it, I go around it. That might take some extra time, or might take a more ingenious way to do it, but Native people are pretty ingenious. You know, that's how we've survived. I always tend to get there, and that's how I got to be a physician. I never gave up. I never gave up on my dream.
This story is produced by Finn Ryan. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from the Lowell and Marriott Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to talk more about the efforts to help Native Americans pursue careers in medicine is Dr. Eric Brote, founding director of the UW-Madison Native American Center for Health Professions. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, ma'am. Good afternoon.
So you tell me a little bit about your path to becoming a doctor. How did you get there?
Well, a lot of my path actually began with Dr. Benally Thompson. That's why it was so enjoyable for me to have the opportunity to listen to his story again and help work with the team to produce his story, because he was actually the first Native American medical student who was a male that I ever met in my life. And as a young student, having that moment where I met somebody who was a tangible role model, I mean, that was a powerful experience for me. And so my path was riddled with people who were my mentors and people who gave me advice. And I still remember that day in June 2001, right? I had the opportunity to meet now Dr. Benally Thompson, and he's someone who I think he lit a fire in me to dare to imagine that I could actually become a physician. And he was a person who was instrumental in being a guide along that path for me.
So it's so interesting. You said he was the first real role model you had, that he lit a fire in you. Do you think that that is something that maybe other Native youth need to go on this path, that tangible proof that this is a path that's open to Native people and it's something that's viable and achievable?
Yeah, and I think that that is part of what we're trying to do at the Native American Center for Health Professions and through this small project with the videos that we're making, is that we're trying to provide, albeit not in person, but very tangible digital role models for students to identify with. Because growing up and through college, I met Native women who were very successful, who were professionals or health professionals. But that one day where I met another Native male who was assuming that role, it all clicked for me, and it made me believe that I could actually do it.
Well, tell us something about the We Are Healers Project. What are you trying to accomplish with that?
Yeah, so the We Are Healers Project is a digital initiative where we're trying to reach out to Native youth across the Great Lakes region, mostly targeting Wisconsin. So it's age group of 10 to 22 with a specific focus of targeting ages 10 to 18 so that we're able to provide stories of people's paths to careers in the health profession.
Now, Dr. Benally Thompson said that Native youth may not have the same opportunities as other students. What are some of the obstacles that might stand in the way, and how are you helping these students move past them?
And one of the main obstacles that we've tried to overcome with the We Are Healers Initiative is providing role models via the digital resource. Because in Wisconsin, there aren't very many Native physicians or Native health professionals that students have access to on a regular basis. And so providing that element of a role model and providing that element of someone who has done this before that's like you is what we're aiming for. Now, some of the obstacles that students may face typically in rural areas is lack of opportunity to either know health professionals themselves and or being in a situation where they have a lot of the advanced placement courses that one might have in more of a suburban type setting.
And can you tell us something about the student recruiting process that that your organization is involved in to get more Native youth on that road to becoming physicians?
Yeah, at the School of Medicine and Public Health, the staff at the Native American Center for Health Professions works broadly with many partners, partners in tribal school systems, partners in tribal organizations, as well as partners within the UW campus and across the colleges in the Great Lakes area to try and identify students that not only have interest but also have the aptitude to become a health professional, and then identifying specific resources that they could take advantage of in order to strengthen their application phase and or their interest so that students don't fall out of the pipeline on their way to becoming a health professional.
Now, you said earlier that there were more role models for Native American women who were healers, not as many men, it sounds like. So does that mean there has been sort of a reverse gender gap in the healing professions for Native Americans?
I just know that that was my experience, and even in organizations nationally, like the Association of American Indian Physicians, there appears to be more women that are in the organization than there are men.
And what do you say to young people, Native American young people, who want to go into the medical field? What advice do you give them?
You know, I really encourage students to draw upon their experiences. I think oftentimes people are told that they will be successful in spite of the challenges that they may have to face. But when I meet Native kids, I try to draw parallels between their life and my life and how maybe there are some challenges that they've gone through that will be the reason why they would be a successful health professional, nurse, physician, physician assistant, dentist, et cetera.
And is it working so far the way it worked for you? Are you seeing more young Native people taking that road?
You know, it's a process where things have to grow organically over time. And for someone to become a health professional, there's a long path. You know, you're talking 10, 12, 14 years sometimes. And so a lot of what we're doing is planting seeds very young, and we're watching them grow slowly over time. So I think that given that the Native American Center for Health Professions is so new, it's difficult to measure our impact over such a short amount of time. However, I do believe that we're seeing some significant results so far as the increased number of students who are attending the School of Medicine Public Health who are Native.
Dr. Broad, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Dr. Eric Broad is the founding director of UW-Madison Native American Center for Health Professions. In new national survey results out today, researchers tried to figure out how widespread campus sexual assault is and what the climate is like on campuses surrounding issues of rape, sexual harassment, partner violence, and more. The survey collected information from 27 campuses around the country.
The UW-Madison was one of the schools taking part in the Campus Climate Survey on Sexual Assault and Sexual Misconduct, organized by the Association of American Universities. At UW-Madison and around the country, about one in four undergraduate women who responded to that survey reported that they had experienced sexual assault.
Dr. Sarah Van Orman joins us now. She's the Executive Director of University Health Services at UW-Madison and chair of a task force managing the survey. Dr. Van Orman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and thanks for discussing this really important topic.
Well, first of all, what kinds of things was the survey trying to find out?
So there were really three things that the survey was looking at. One, it wanted to be able to look at what was the prevalence of these different kinds of sexual violence on our campuses. They also wanted to get information about what students thought about the climate, what were their feelings about what was happening, and finally to ask students about what their knowledge about student campus resources were and procedures for responding. So those are really kind of the three big components of the survey.
Now, in terms of the results themselves, we've been seeing statistics maybe similar to these, but what seems especially unusual about this is just the scope of the data that came in. Tell us about how that compares to the data we've had so far.
Yeah, so certainly the 1 in 4, 1 in 5 number that's been used many times has been found on other surveys in the past, and there are differences between the AAU survey and previous surveys. But what was unique about this was the large number of campuses that participated and the large number of students that participated. So previous surveys had either been on a small number of students at a large number of campuses or one or two campuses. This survey really was unique in that it was all students on many campuses, and it allowed us to get much more information, particularly about how students' experiences differed on campuses, and also differences in the kinds of sexual assault and misconduct they were experiencing, and then also differences between the experience of various different types of students. So this is really valuable, unique information.
Now, this comes in the midst of a national conversation about sexual assault on college campuses. How does this new information fit into the picture of what we already have, what we think we know from current research?
You know, I think it really confirms much of what we know, that this is an extremely prevalent concern. It also confirms that why this is something that institutions of higher education pay attention to. One of the questions in the survey asked about what consequences the students had experienced, and it gave them a choice between things like academic consequences, physical, emotional. And academic consequences was one of the most common things that students reported, with over 50% of students indicating that that had been an adverse outcome. So we think about why institutions of higher education take this on. There's lots of reasons. But essentially what the students are telling us is this is keeping them from getting an education.
Now, I want to get into the numbers here at the UW. Now, as we mentioned, you've said the 1 in 4 undergraduate women who responded to the survey, again, this was sent to all the students on campus, they say they experienced some form of sexual assault. Does that fit in, again, with what you've seen, and how does that compare to the national numbers that came back?
Yeah, so what the 1 in 4, or 27.6% of our female undergraduates, indicated that since they had been enrolled here, they had experienced a sexual assault involving being physically forced or while they were incapacitated. And sexual assault includes penetration, attempted penetration, as well as other things like sexual touching and other kinds of assault. That number is actually slightly higher than what the national average on the survey was, which was right around 23%, but very much keeping in line with what other campuses found.
We're talking right now with Dr. Sarah Van Orman, Executive Director of UW-Madison's University Health Services, and we're looking at a new national report on sexual assault and sexual misconduct on college campuses, in particular right now at the UW. And alcohol is a factor that often gets linked to sexual assault. How did that link play out here at the UW?
Yeah, so alcohol is a very, what we would say about this is the common factor in sexual assault. And I want to be absolutely clear that consuming alcohol or being incapacitated is no reason, no one deserves to experience a sexual assault. We want to focus the alcohol issue, which has historically been focused on the victim. We want to change that to how alcohol affects the bystanders and affects perpetrators. What we know is that our students told us that students who had experienced a sexual assault, over 70% of them on our campus, the offender had been drinking. We know that also that alcohol is commonly used as a way for offenders to make their victims less able to defend themselves. And finally, we know that alcohol changes the ability of bystanders to recognize dangerous situations. For example, in one of our campuses, it asked students if they had witnessed someone, a drunk person or someone who was incapacitated, heading for a sexual encounter. And over half of our students indicated that they had seen that, significantly higher, actually, than the national average. But many of them really were not able to or didn't know what they needed to do to intervene.
Now, you said significantly higher than the national average here in Wisconsin at UW. What do you make of that?
Well, I think we certainly know that alcohol, high-risk alcohol use is a challenge on our campus, like it is many institutions of higher education, and something that we work on. But our high-risk alcohol consumption among our students and our undergraduates are higher than what we see nationally. So it's not a number that surprises us, but it definitely is a number that really gives credence to some of the work that we've been doing to reduce that among our undergraduates.
Now, there are programs that all incoming students have to go through. One involves being educated about consent and sexual assault and all of those things. Is alcohol part of that education process that students go through now, considering the link and considering the strength of those numbers here at the UW?
Yeah, so there's two mandatory programs that all incoming undergraduates are required to participate in. The first is called Tonight, and Tonight is our sexual assault and dating violence program. It includes information about not only resources and reporting, how to respond to a friend, what consent is, but also helps students learn to recognize how to be a good bystander. And some of the scenarios in that program deal with very much that situation, that what are the red flags when someone might be incapacitated and a potential perpetrator might be using alcohol in order to make a victim less able to respond. So although that's not the primary focus of the Tonight program, it definitely is a piece of it. We also have a mandatory first-year education program called Alcohol EDU that all incoming students are also required to complete. And that program focuses on recognizing high-risk drinking, helping students to understand how many drinks, what that does to their body physiologically helps them set better expectations about alcohol. So we have, for the past 2 years, required all of our incoming students to complete both of those programs.
Now, how often do cases go unreported?
Well, that's one of the things that is, definitely we knew, in kind of from very limited amounts of data, and certainly anecdotally we knew that. But this survey really provides us some solid information in that, and it is sobering. We know that on our campus, we think about a very serious incident of sexual assault when someone was physically forced and was actually had a penetrative assault, which is very serious. Even in those cases, only about 26.1% of students reported that. When they had that same penetrated assault, but they happened involving their incapacitation, less than 10% of students reported that.
We're talking right now with Dr. Sarah Van Orman, Executive Director of UW-Madison's University Health Services. We're looking at a new national report on sexual assault and sexual misconduct on college campuses.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a student, a parent, or if you work on a campus, what do you think works? What needs to change when it comes to preventing sexual assault on college campuses? What kind of programs are in place on your campus? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with Dr. Sarah Van Orman from UW-Madison's University Health Services, looking at a new national survey on sexual assault and sexual harassment on college campuses. The survey included 27 campuses around the country, including UW-Madison.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to change on college campuses? If you have a stake in the story as a parent, as a student, someone who works on a campus, what's your perspective? Call 800-642-1234. And we were talking earlier about the link, the factor of alcohol in these sexual assaults on college campuses. And given the Wisconsin drinking culture that we hear about in the state, is there any effort, do you think, to coordinate an approach addressing both those things as sort of a vector on university campuses?
That's an area of emerging intersection, and again, we want to be very clear that no one deserves to be sexually assaulted, and that a focus on victim consumption of alcohol at putting them at risk is really kind of takes the responsibility off of where it needs to lie, and that's with perpetrators. But that being said, I think that we are moving forward on our campus with a dialogue to say, how does a culture of high-risk drinking or an alcohol culture kind of set the stage to facilitate sexual assault? Again, I don't want to focus on alcohol as the only cause. There's lots of factors that are contributing, but certainly this is an important part of the solution, and I think campuses nationally are starting to kind of think about that. On our campus here, alcohol prevention and efforts are coordinated through the health service, but also in close collaboration with our Division of Student Life, our police department, our Division of University Housing, and we work very closely, and we think about these two issues as very different issues, but ones that intersect in which we want to coordinate on. So we actually do this all the time here at UW-Madison, particularly in a state that where we do have challenges around alcohol.
We have a caller on the line now. We've got Patty with us in Door County. Patty, hi.
Hi.
What is your take on this?
Well, just listening to the talk, I totally, am on board with the fact that, yes, sexual assault should never happen. There's no excuse for it, period. But my question is, what kind of education is being directed toward these young women that put themselves in compromising situations? Is there something being done specifically to target them and say, ladies, don't be stupid. Don't put yourself in a situation that you know probably won't end well. As an example, my son, who's a sophomore at a different UW school, just the other day, he and his friends were hanging around in the dorm, and these freshman girls came up to them and said, hey, do you know where we can find a party? you know, what's being done to help these young ladies, particularly, you know, freshmen, for example, that are very naive, don't go there.
Patty, thank you so much for the call. And Dr. Van Orman, how do you draw that line or walk the line between safety education and putting the onus on women, for example?
Right, absolutely. So I appreciate the caller, and in particular, I appreciate her mentioning the issue of first-year students, because we certainly know, and the survey supported, that first-year students are at the greatest risk. They're in a new environment. They're, you know, kind of new experiences. They don't know people. So absolutely, that's an area and a group of students we want to be spending a lot of time with. I think it's very important that all students, young women and young men, understand what's happening on their campus, that they have this information, that they have good safety information, they have good information about alcohol so that they can make responsible decisions. But I also think it's important that we educate young women about the all of these things. But I think it's also really important that we spend a lot of time talking to our young men and saying, young men, don't sexually assault. That, you know, don't rape. That's probably the most important message that parents and family members and friends need to talk with them to understand. Why is it that perpetration happens? What are all those factors? And how do we engage men as part of the solution for this?
And what resources do you want people to know about, parents, staff, students, about sexual assault and to help survivors?
Yeah, we've got a lot of resources here on our campus, and I know I'm familiar with the rest of the system. I think there's a lot of resources across the system. The first is here at our campus, starting with prevention. We have our Tonight program. We also have a really excellent parent handbook that you don't have to be a UW-Madison parent to download. It's available on our website at www.uhs.wis.edu. That I, even parents of high school students, that is, it's titled Talking to Your Student About Sexual Assault. And I think it's a wonderful resource. We know that parents who talk to their children about healthy sexuality and consent and boundaries, that those students are more likely to report if something happens to them. So that's a great resource I would mention. Here at the Health Service for Students, we have our medical and mental health services. We also have a confidential victim advocate where students can come and meet with someone if they have concerns about themselves and a friend. Finally, here on campus, we have through our offices of the Dean of Students, the offices of Equity, Diversity, and our police department are all places students can go if they want to make a report and they've experienced a sexual assault. So we think, you know, whether a student is ready to come forward and report, we want them to come forward to those offices. If they just want to talk with someone confidentially, those resources are available as well.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Sarah Van Orman, Executive Director of University Health Services, talking about a new survey of sexual assault and sexual misconduct on college campuses around the country and at UW-Madison.